This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. My name is Zephyr, and you're listening to Frank Prattle. This is an interview with William Pym of Fleischer Ullman Gallery in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, the beginning of the interview cut out, the microphone cut out for the first 5 minutes or so of it, but we come in with William talking about listening to pirate radio in London when he was growing up.
You could feel it. I mean, emotions were traveling across the air. This was the sort of twilight of rave culture when it was getting quite, in London at least, dark and diffuse. There was a sort of diaspora of non-English influences. I mean, West Indian, Black African culture was infecting it. And these weren't the people we saw on the streets. These weren't the people we were out when we went out with. We were going to pubs. We didn't see Black West Indian people. It was as vivid as anything I've experienced in my short life. I mean, this is 15 years ago, and I remember the name of every station: Pulse FM, Freak FM, Heat FM, Cool FM, Dream FM, Cool with a K. That was one thing they said on the air a lot. I remember their frequencies. Remember the phone number, 0831-187-370. That was the phone number for Dream FM. These were the sort of primitive cell phone numbers. You had to call. It cost you probably about the equivalent of $2 in change to get a 20-second call to the DJ to say, they would just pick up the phone and you would say, can I have a shout? And you didn't want to screw it up or come off like you were square. And I had to run down four floors to get to the payphone to call out for a rewind. And you know, I can tell you a dozen times when I went down and they'd pick up the phone, I'd say, rewind, like, as best that I didn't know how to do it. And they were like, we're in the mix. You want us to rewind the mix? I was like, rewind the mix. And I'd go back upstairs and my roommate who would be taping would be like, you just called in to rewind the mix. They were just slamming you on the air because you asked to do it. I was like, I didn't know, man. They're like, you fucking idiot. You're so lame. They're like, all right, next time you're going to call for the show. And we didn't have money. This was like change that we had cobbled together from like buying candy bars. It was, I truly believe, and I believe to this day, and I listen, Rinse FM is a sort of latter-day station that rincefm.com is streaming worldwide from London right now. I listen to it periodically. I stream it. They have Sunday afternoon shows. It's the same deal. The names have changed, but they're still saying, you know, where you at? Come to the rave next weekend. Thanks to everyone who came to the rave last night and talking about who was there, how they, sorry I didn't make it out to Purple last night, you know, apologizing. Like, I got stuck in traffic. I was at Sidewinder until 2 a.m. I didn't go on until 2 a.m. Come back next week, I'll be there. But then it's like, they say, we got listeners texting us or instant messaging us from Canada, but hold tight Canada. Just like, you know, I'm all for the world getting smaller, but community-oriented activity will remain. I mean, it's enlightening to be in Canada and to hear someone in London, the way they speak and the way they live their lives.
It's immediate. I think that's one of the things that people love.
Yeah.
Is that you get the feeling that not only is somebody with you, but they're in the fucking room with you at that moment.
Yeah, it's a wonderful feeling. But even this is not enough for me. I need to, perhaps I'm just being sort of excessively nostalgic or like missing this place that I've been, but you could have been there. And if you hear it from the transmitter with those radio waves stretching to meet you, physically, it's to me almost as good as being there, and it's as empowering as being there. And for all the wonderful things that the internet and digital communication is offering to us. And I learn a lot from that, as do you, as does anyone who's tuned in. There's never going to be a substitute for that experience, for a wave, you know, a wave. Well, I don't know the science of it, man, but basically I'm all for both, and I'm all for radio. I don't think there's anything better. And hold tight, because in 2 months, if you live within 6 blocks of me, I'm a broadcast for you every day in the Northern Liberties area of Philadelphia. Just need a name. Zephyr FM, probably. Zephyr
FM. This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. You're listening to William Pym in Philadelphia at Black Floor Gallery, up in the top of a grain silo or some shit. I don't know where the hell we are. Tell us a little bit about your gallery, Fleischmann Ullman, I believe it's called.
No, I can't do that, man. I blew my load. I'm too emotional at this point, too excited. I can't tell you about this. I'm a commercial dealer by day, but none of that matters. I can't talk no more about this.
All right. So he's playing coy with us on the radio. Tell us, you had mentioned earlier that you might be in love. Tell us about that.
Oh, come on, Doug.
This is on the spot.
Could be for the first time. Just patience. Patience is the key.
Are you afraid you'll blow it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, men and women are very different. And if you got ambition or drive as a man, you're going to try the patience of a lot of women, in my opinion. Because they come a lot quicker to the... They give in, you know, give in to it. Right here in Philadelphia in 1978, Elton John recorded perhaps the best material he ever did in his career with Larry Bell of the Philadelphia International Records. And he cut a song called Are You Ready for Love, which was just devastating. And I'm not even a huge fan of Elton John, but I think of this song. And he asked a pretty sincere question. Are you ready? Are you ready for love? And it's a question that every partnership, before the confusion and the nonsense starts, if they asked each other that sincerely, and if people thought to themselves that, they wouldn't get in problems. It's just a very simple question. And the thing that's with me right now is, am I ready? And it's my decision. And you just gotta listen to yourself. No, this is a different kind of radio program.
Well, you know, we skip around at NPR, you know?
But yeah, I mean, that's what I say. Are you ready? Am I ready? Time will tell. I hope so. I'm listening.
So you're going to start your own station here soon?
Absolutely.
And any idea what maybe the format would be? Is it going to be maybe community engagement? Or do you want to play some records?
Music, yeah. I love music.
Yeah.
And talking. I want, but I don't know what to tell. I don't know what to tell people about or where to go. I mean, the nature of publicity in a small town. It's hard to find a niche, or it's hard to find even something that you want to encourage people to do. And I don't, at this point in my life, I don't, the sort of social circuit is something that, I've been here 5 years now, and I don't party anymore, I don't go out anymore, I'm not looking for new places and new things. I'll play a lot of music, and I will, well, you know what, there's a wonderful radio station here, Megawords Radio. You can, at Megawords, megawordsmagazine.com. They have an archive of radio shows they've done on a local internet station, radiovolta.org, which is an anarchist radio station based in West Philadelphia. And I've played on their show. It's every Thursday night, 8 till 10. It's streamed there and it's archived on Megawords. That's the template for really, because it's each week a discrete group of people getting together, and you just enter into that interaction. You're invited to a party once a week from 8 to 10. It's a new group of people. It's artists, It is musicians, rappers, rap live, sports talk from like South Philly dudes. Just show the extent of the people who these guys have come into contact with their life. It's a picture of their life and the lives they lead and the people they've met. And they're from Philadelphia. I'm not from Philadelphia. I got some things to figure out, Zephyr, about the format of Zephyr FM. But I'll get there, and I'll keep you posted for sure.
One of the things that I particularly love about radio and growing up in a town, I actually grew up in Alaska, and there was some radio there, but I worked for a public radio station when I was in high school called K2, and I remember listening to it, you know, on nights when I wasn't, you know, volunteering there.
What did you do for them?
I was a horrible DJ. They put me like super late at night, like 3 a.m. You know, they gave me that shift because they were like, "Oh, put the kid over there," you know. And then, you know, during the day they'd play neighborhood public radio or national rather public radio.
Sure.
But one of the things that I remember about it was that it beat the fuck out of television because there was the imagination of it. Like you could create the entire world within your head and all the physical aspects of radio. And I wonder if, you know, you wouldn't mind talking about some of that, some of the images that you had or that, you know, you carry with you about, you know, radio and, you know, maybe some of your bigger dreams in life. That's a big one, I'm sorry.
That's a very good question. Well, I'll take it back to being 14 in London. You know, a wonderful thing about the art world, which is, I would say the world I inhabit because I spend time with artists, where art is the sort of top topic of discussion. And beyond that, business-wise, the art world. One, the question enters of cool. People being cool, people being square, people presenting some sort of picture of themselves that gives them credibility, toughness. I mean, I carry a knife, for example. I
show it to you right. Can we see it?
Yeah. I carry this with me at all times. And I show it to, and this is just, I mean, this is just sort of posturing. This is a French farmer's knife. It's extremely sharp.
I'm feeling the knife currently, and that is definitely indeed sharp.
I mean, that's an aside, basically, but people spend a lot of time and get tangled up in their early career as artists trying to position themselves as something that they are not. They're sort of fleeing from embracing just who they are. You know, if they're bookish or like to play chess or were awkward or just, I mean, the stance is that you've got to be smooth and you've got to have done it all to be an artist. This isn't remotely true at all, and a happier future I could see is if people were candid from the start, and it save critics, viewers, and fellow artists, and friends, and family. It would save them a huge amount of time. They wouldn't have to sort of slice through all these layers of artifice. When I was listening to whomever telling me, you know, come to, you know, Dreamscape tomorrow night. It's like, we're going to see you there at Milton Keynes Bagley Studios. It's like, come there. I wasn't going to come there. I was never going to come there. I understood then that I had access to something that I was able to enjoy something without ever thinking that I was going to become this person. I was able to enjoy something alien without feeling jealousy or insecurity or inferiority. And this is at the absolute root of, you know, you ask me about bigger things for the world, is that people are afraid of what they aren't. And that's not even that big a deal. And this is at the absolute core of the American position, politically speaking. And what was I supposed to be? Angry that I was 13 and wasn't allowed out late at night and couldn't go raving? When I heard it on the radio, I was like, I feel like I could hold my own there. No, I just accepted it and enjoyed what I could understand and what was available to me. I'm all for aspiration and dreams, but aspiration to me is fulfilling your potential, not inventing or entering or transforming yourself into someone else. There's a lot of things you can be and stay you.
So one of the things that I'm sensing when you're talking about it is a sense of honesty coming across, not only in your art practice, but really in your own life. Yeah. And how you comport yourself.
Yeah.
Do you find that hard to, you know, kind of skate that line between bullshit and staying true?
Yeah, I perform all day long. And I mean, I've broken telephones in my gallery because I get off the phone with someone and I slam the handset down. Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And I slam it down.
One of my favorite things as well.
Yeah, it's just brilliant. I mean, because it's the only way. It's just that's the only act of violence that I participate in. It's just this sort of exorcism of being obliged to perform. I might be obliged to perform because I have to talk a certain way. Because if I do, then someone will buy a stone sculpture made by a very simple man from Tennessee in 1941 for $400,000. And if I do that, I'll have enough money to fly back to England or buy like the biggest fucking stack of records at the Princeton Record Exchange. It's that simple, and I'll be able to pay my electricity bill, my cell phone bill.
I know it's tough, man. I know. How often, and I'll answer this question too, so I won't put you on the fucking spot without coming back. How often do you think you lie a day?
At least once every day. On evenings like this, at a 2-hour art opening, whether a lie is actively something said or a lie in something unsaid, between 6 and 8 p.m. tonight, I lied to 20 different people probably, in some way or another. How about you between 6 and 8 p.m. tonight?
6 and 8 p.m. tonight?
What, were you in a car for half that time?
Well, no, I was definitely at the opening.
But you knew fewer people.
Definitely.
So you were in a position where you could, where candor wasn't a problem. For me, the expectations of, I know the directors of the ICA down. I know 30 people who worked there. The only person who I was able to be candid with who was a professional tonight was a woman I met tonight, Naomi Beckwith,
who's fabulous.
Wonderful, straightforward person, and was really easy to riff with, and it was a blessing because we're off on the right foot straight away. And the other folks at the ICA, we got to negotiate back down from a position where we've started off just not even being ourselves. And it's possible we'll never even get a chance to be candid with each other. And those people you're just never going to work with. You're never going to understand each other. But, you can't win them all. How often do you lie a day? Don't take today. I mean, take another day then.
Take an average day?
Yeah.
I would say I probably lie, and I try, and I'm fairly vigilant about this, so I'm being truthful when I tell you, probably 3 to 4 times a day. But then again, in my line of work, I don't have to lie, or not necessarily lie, but cater to a certain class of people who want to hear something. I mean, I do, because I sell paintings. But then again, that's the gallerist's position. That's their 50%.
50%? What a terrible proportion that is. No, it's absolutely savage. I mean, no other business in the world do you find people taking that bigger cut of someone's soul. No other business in the world.
That's... Matt? None comes to mind, but I'm sure we'll have somebody call in.
I mean, there's people who work for pennies a day in certain countries of this world, but this is a supposedly culturally evolved and sort of high practice.
Supposedly the highest. I read Now, this is something I'd want to talk about, and this is totally the other fucking end of the spectrum, but related. It's, I don't know if I fucking want to go there, actually. But I'm going to go there quickly, and if you don't want to hit it, that's fine. We'll go on to something else. At Art Basel this year in Miami, there were people talking about the fact that in the 2000 stock market crash, right, in the dot-com crash, of which my town, San Francisco, got fucking hit like a brick and sank pretty much. The one thing that did not lose money while the stock market was plummeting was art, and that banks have begun to buy art instead of stock to hold value.
And this, that being true, which is something I've never discussed with anyone, it would explain why art is in the state that it is in now, which is driven by investors entirely. I mean, auctions, young artists, MFA shows. It is patronage. It's not. Patronage has left the realm of the industrialist who wishes to find something to do with his money and prove that he has culture. He didn't just build a railroad. He wanted to bring something to America. The vitality of art, economically speaking, in America is driven by the speculation of Wall Street men who don't know what to do with their money but decide to invest in art in order that they make more money. Frick or whomever, he's my favorite because he has my favorite collection. He wasn't buying his art in order to make more money down the line. And that's better. I mean, we have him to thank, really. But
one of the things I was going to talk about, though, or ask you, rather, about, is given that state, how long do you think art can last? I mean, is it just another stock then? And is it eating itself out from the inside?
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, you know.
Absolutely. And more people are the glamour and the publicity of it all. I mean, I write for a diary, a blog essentially, on artforum.com, which is read by 50,000 people a week, which is a social, which is entirely a social calendar. The glamour of art is encouraging artists to. I mean, there's thousands of artists a year coming out of grad programs with the hope of being on the cover of magazines and throwing fabulous parties and being stupendously wealthy and getting beautiful homes filled with art of other people who felt the same way. I don't see a way back from that. I truly don't see a way of recovery from that. What we have going on right now and what you have going on right now, which is returning to person value, I mean, it's so extreme that one has to sort of claw it back from the bottom. But the furthest other end of the spectrum is to group, to build groups from the bottom, starting with two people. You know, you got your first listener on the radio, and then if that person, you know, it's cellular. That is the essence of this show that seems like hours ago that we were talking about, but that is at its heart what this show should have as its thesis.
As the show of the ICA, yeah.
localized gravity, right. Something like this, but it's like the pull is to local. If we start there, I mean, one is choosing to spend one's time and one's money on other people, essentially, instead of oneself. If you buy a $1 million painting, you buy a $1 million painting at auction, the artist has absolutely nothing to do with it. You're not offering any form of support to a single person. You're giving 20% of it to Sotheby's. Sotheby's incidentally raised its commission on every auction because of the robustness. Today it announced that it was per sale, it was gonna raise the commission. So already there's a buyer's premium of 18%, and it's been raised, I'm not sure by how many percent, but they're like, wow, the art market is so robust, we're going to take even more out of every sale. And this is money that people are spending on themselves. It's not being spent on other people. And people can choose to spend their money and their time on other people. And if they do that, who knows? I figured that, well, you know, if there's another great economic crash, will the bankers protect the art again? It's hard to know. I mean, I don't know. I hope that, well, God knows. I mean, man.
I think that one of the main points that it comes down to that you brought up earlier is that essentially, and this is true from poor to rich across the board, and regardless of race, color, or creed, is that everybody wants to be cool. Yeah. And that from kids in high school who are trying out the latest styles in baggy pants and crazy hair to CEO board reps who make millions of dollars, they want to be cool just as much. And one of the ways they do that is the flashy painting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and people should. The thing is, some people are good at making money. I mean, there are people with economic brains. There are people who, you know, I talked about people fulfilling their potential, and some people fulfilling their potential is making money. So I'm not saying that, like, a capitalistic state of mind is something that must be, like, banished from the world, because there are people who are very good at using math to make things grow. But there are people who choose to make money, who put that as their priority, which is just people should figure out seriously what their place in the world is. And the only way you can do that is by being surrounded by other people who know what their place in the world is. And on Wall Street, the guy next to you is, what are you buying with your bonus this year? I'm going to get a timeshare in Barbados. Me, I'm going to get a duplex on Central Park West. Me, I'm buying like a yellow Lamborghini. They're all just...
Me, I'm buying a Takahashi Murakami.
Oh, man, yeah.
Well, actually, God, if you're out there, God, stick a fork in my ass and turn me over, because I would be fucking done before I bought a painting like that. Anyway, never mind.
Exactly. I mean, that's the next step. It's just, yeah, we're going nowhere with this. I mean, as not you and I mean, culturally speaking, well, I think we're going somewhere quite interesting, but there's no answer.
What? Here's a question that I have for you then. What do you consider?
You think we're getting somewhere? I mean, this is all very much sort of tip of the tongue thoughts that are coming to you. Am I sort of repeating myself or going in circles? Do you think we're making progress? Because I think perhaps we are.
I think that we're definitely making progress. I mean, one of the things I believe in personally, and you know, perhaps you do too, is that the strongest connection is some like a pseudo spiritual connection that happens strictly between two people, that there's no larger circuit than that that can encompass that. Man, you know what I mean?
Zephyr, you're talking about that question you asked me about love, and this is from, you know, the obstinance of a man. There's a liberation in realizing, I mean, not man to woman, there's all kinds of different one-to-one connections that people make, but I do believe that there is one that is more profound than all others. When people make that is the core of contemporary spirituality. There's no group. I mean, that is where people will find the answers, is understanding that there is, as you so beautifully put it, that shortest circuit. I mean, that's the perfect allegory for the electrical age that we live in. Find the cleanest circuit. Find the one that won't break down. And that is, and then then there's the person who's, you know, buying a painting is sort of sacrament of that bond. And it is, no one's duping the other person. No one's taking the other person for a ride. That is when a painting is worth how much it costs. And that could mean that a painting is worth $1 million. Because that's how good that bond is and how deep that understanding is. And just the inflation, I mean. And I come into contact with this every day, and this is me slamming the phone every day. I mean, Yoshitomo Nara, I don't know if you know about this guy.
Nara. The big eyes.
Yeah, he sold a painting. I'm sort of tossing around the painting at the moment that was bought 3 years ago for $40,000, which I'm now trying to sell to people for $750,000. And why is it $750,000? Because we got the auction results in one day, and it said that a similar painting of a similar size from the same series sold for $750,000 at auction. Therefore, this painting that a lovely couple, I can't say who they are or where they're from, a lovely wealthy couple bought for $40,000 and fell in love with. It's not to my taste, but that was not the shortest circuit because it was mediated through a dealer, but it was a small circuit. And now a dealer I know phones them the morning after the auction results, is like, says, I can get you $750,000 for your Nara. And what do they say? They say, sell, sell, sell. And it's, this is so far away from this sort of essential exchange. And as you say, it's as far as could possibly be away from a spiritual transaction, a daily spirituality. It's ludicrous. And this is what gets me slamming the phone. And yet, well, it continues to happen. This is just the one I came into contact with. You know, in Chelsea, well, God knows. I don't know. What else do you want to talk about?
Well, why don't we take a break? Maybe we'll hit it back again.
Let's go back to the party. Let's see where our friends are. Thank you, Zephyr.
This is 88.9 FM, Neighborhood Public Radio. You're listening to Zephyr, and the show is called Frank Prattle. We've had William Pym on, my most gracious host here in Philadelphia at Black Floor Gallery, the after party of the ICA show Locally Localized Gravity, where they tore the fucking house down. Thanks, William.
Thanks.
I gotta get you...